Hello and welcome to another Glenbrook podcast. And today I've probably got the most exciting person I've had on so far, because it's about my passion at the end of this. And as some of you know, I'm mad about all things that move. And Sarah Jane Curtis, who we have on the line today, is from Bistamotion, which is an incredible project in Oxfordshire, which revolves around all things that move. And I'm incredibly excited. But I know Sarah Jane because we've been, well, she's actually been my boss when I was at Grosvenor, and she's also been my wife's boss. And so we've got a long connection going back into the late 90s. And she's had the most incredible career through Grosvenor and various other places. So we're going to talk about Sarah Jane's career progression, where she was at university, how she got into the big jobs that she's had. And we're going to dwell on Bistamotion as well, because it's a one-off project in this country, and it's actually an international project. So following on from Dr. Richard Barkham last time, who is on the line from Boston, where we went international, this is an international project that's got a vast reach. So terribly excited. So hello, Sarah Jane.
Hello, Guy. That was a bit of an ambitious welcome. I hope I can live up to the billing, really.
Well, I'm mega excited because I went down to see Bistamotion in 7 or 8 years ago, and it was incredible then. And the ambitions you guys have got are absolutely huge.
They are, and it's a really fascinating project, particularly something, well, I can tell you how I got there, but perhaps we should start at the beginning, shall we?
Absolutely. So, first of all, where are you today, calling from today? Where do we find you today?
So I'm actually in London today, guys. So I work in Bista Monday to Thursdays, and then I come back home for the weekend. And I moved to Bista 3 years ago when I joined Value Retail to run Bista Village. Liked it so much, I bought a little cottage up there, and it's actually blissful living half the week in the country, half the week in London.
Sounds perfect. And so you're in London, I'm in Cheshire, because we're all on lockdown still to a certain extent. I did pop into the office this week and there was not a lot going on in Manchester, so I'm in Cheshire. And in terms of where you grew up and sort of founded your interest in property through university, what was that background?
Okay, so, well, despite the fact I don't sound it, I'm a Geordie. Grew up in Newcastle. See, I still say Newcastle, not Newcastle. Yeah. And was very sporty, played quite high level tennis and had a place at Loughborough University to do PE sports science. And my father said to me, do you really want to do your career as your hobby? Or your hobby as your career? And I said, well, what the hell do I do then? And he said to me, well, I've never seen a poor estate agent. Why don't you try that? And I went literally, okay, so where do I go? So I ended up changing my university application at the last minute. And Leicester Poly were kind enough to take me on, basically. So I did 3 years at Leicester Poly, now De Montfort University. And then, like everybody else, you felt you had to go to London to get fully qualified. Mm-hmm. So I joined Edward Erdman in, I'm not even going to say the year because I'm so old now. And I did 2 years getting fully qualified at Edward Erdman. And then my closest friend from college, Janet Walker, was working for Grosvenor. And I used to meet her for lunch, and she had her own office, her own PA. And she had a really, really nice job, in my opinion, whereas I'd been photocopying and following people around for 2 years. And she announced she was moving back to Yorkshire to get engaged. And would I be interested in her job? And I said, oh, I'd love to come and talk. So I went and met the estate surveyor, who basically told me all about Grosvenor, and then sort of said, and when can you start, without asking me any questions about it? So that's how I ended up just qualified at Grosvenor. I negotiated my salary with the estate surveyor's PA, who told me I was being a bit greedy, asking for an extra £500. And I think I was on £10,000 per annum at that stage. So that was my career start. And then I, as you know, I was at Grosvenor a rather long time.
Yeah, so, and a lot changed in that period, in that I You remind me actually of us having our own offices. I had an amazing office with a balcony overlooking the gardens. I think it was on Davis Street or Brook Street, actually, around the corner on Brook Street. And then the big change happened when we moved to 70 Grosvenor Street in 2000.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, I started Grosvenor when there were 70 people in the organisation, and I think now they're well over 1,000. So whilst I grew up there, I think the company grew up there. I joined just after Jeremy Newsom joined, and he was in fact my first boss. And of course he ended up as, you know, the late Duke's sort of right hand man and chairman of the trustees. So it was really nice working for him for the first year. And I spent 8 years doing London estate work. They threw you in the deep end. I was running part of Belgravia within a year. And as you can imagine, I can't wait to write the book when I retire, because I've got some amazing stories of my time there, most of which I guess has to remain confidential. But there was no doubt it was brilliant training ground. You could do as much or as little as you liked there. And it was really, really interesting working on the London estate. But after 8 years, I got a bit bored. And coming back from maternity leave, they asked if I'd like to run the shopping centre property management portfolio, which was based in Northampton, but they were bringing them back to London. So not really knowing anything about shopping centres, I'm suddenly running a team of 12 people who aren't particularly happy to be brought back to London. And that really was more property and asset management. And then we went from that to setting up the Arkell Fund. So I got really involved with a guy called Ian Coburn. Yep. And Mark Preston, who now is chairman of the trustees. He was my graduate, poor sod, in setting up what was the Arkell Fund, where Grosvenor effectively sold into the fund three of their shopping centres that they'd developed 20 years earlier. It was a good way to effectively diversify, bring in more money, but also retain the sort of management mandate for it.
Sure. And then what assets, I mean, you owned quite a few. Was it seven shopping centres in the Arkell portfolio?
Yep. By the time it grew, yes, we did. We bought others. We also set up a fund with, the Illinois, basically Farmers Retirement Fund. And we bought the second shopping centre in Walsall with them. And it was incredibly incongruous. They would come over each year to do a shopping centre tour with us from Chicago, having really never been to London. And I remember we used to put them up in Claridge's and they used to complain that the stairs creaked. It would be much better in a modern hotel. It was just very different from them, from what they were used to. But so that was a joint venture with LaSalle Investment Management.
Yeah. Okay.
Just as LaSalle effectively set up their London operation. Gosh, trawling back my memory here, Guy.
That was phenomenal.
So that was Bruce Bossom. The guys who now run Orion, they were effectively LaSalle when they set up their London office in, and this was a joint venture fund that we had with them. So that was really different, going from London estate to suddenly going over to Chicago in January every year to do a presentation to 30 ex-retired farmers from Illinois.
That's incredible. And then you moved into the development side of the business, didn't you, after that?
Well, in 2000, when we moved to our new office, they restructured the business and I was asked to head up the retail team alongside John Bullough. And John effectively headed up the development side and I headed up the investment side.
Okay, yeah.
And that's where you got involved, really. That was Basingstoke.
Yeah.
And Liverpool. And there were also refurbishments of other shopping centres that we owned.
And was Cambridge on the table then as well?
Oh, gosh. Grafton Centre Cambridge. I managed Grafton Centre Cambridge for Mercury Asset Management, which was really quite interesting. And then we built an extension on Grafton Centre, and that's where I came across the development side of our business, or Grosvenor Developments and Grosvenor Estates, really didn't overlap until they restructured and put them effectively together. And it was really interesting when they started to do that, because we had a proper retail function effectively. But Grafton Centre was quite interesting.
And then the one where we both came across each other more was Liverpool One, of course. And you ended up being the fund manager when it was all built and open and running.
Yeah. So I had a really good induction with Liverpool. So I was involved in the development side in pitching for it, just on the periphery. And then I looked at the first retail mix planning along with Rod Holmes, who is the development director for the project, a real legend. So I worked with him on what started off as four quarters and became five quarters for some reason, the retail mix planning. And then I went back and worked for the London Estate for 8 years and then came back when it finally built as fund manager.
I'd forgotten those 8 years.
Yeah, and having been in the interim, so part of my role when I went back to the London Estate was looking at Grosvenor's investment holdings in its shopping centre portfolio. So I effectively sat on the board as the investor and then went there as the fund manager. So I ended up almost being reported to and suddenly reporting to the same group of people I'd sat on the board with. So it was a bit surreal, but it was fascinating. So I missed, effectively, Guy, all the really hard work at Liverpool.
Did I don't know if it's an appropriate time to bring it in, but being a woman in property, did it ever, when you were at Grosvenor or since, have you ever noticed a difference effectively? Because certainly I never saw you any different in the company, certainly at Grosvenor. Have you found it more difficult being a woman in property, do you think?
I tell you, I'm sad about the fact that there are no more women percentage-wise in property than there were when I started 30 years ago. That's a sad fact for me. It's still a bit of a boys' game, particularly certain areas of property. Having said that, I don't think the profession really sells itself as to what it is and how broad it is and what it can offer. And whenever I get the opportunity to tell people about what I do, I think people are fascinated how varied my career has been and how it could be for other people. So I'm sort of sad about that. And actually, I'll just give you an anecdote. My daughter went to a pretty academic London school and I was asked to go to one of their career shows. So I take two very good looking male graduates, you probably shouldn't say that nowadays, to this sort of show. And I'm put on a stand next to a knee surgeon on one side and a dentist on the other. And this knee surgeon had a graphic video of replacing of a knee. And the queues for the doctors and the queues for the dentist were massive. And I think I saw three people that night who were interested in surveying.
Really?
And it was quite interesting talking to the knee surgeon, because he said effectively, you know, those are parent-pleasing careers those girls are talking, because they don't know what other things are around. So I sort of feel, though I've not done anything about it, I feel quite strongly it's such a shame that we don't promote what property could be as a career, because it's very varied. So that's one point. I think from my perspective, I've always taken a view, it doesn't matter whether you're male or female, it's how good you are. And it's very much a career about people. I'm interested in people and I'm interested in building relationships with people. And that's how I've sort of gone through my career effectively. It also helps that I play golf and I can hit the ball as far as most men I've played in golf days with, which I think they find really quite frustrating. But I found sport really helped me as a woman in property.
That's really interesting about the first point about education or sharing what property is, because that's something I've dipped in and out of over the years, trying to educate people, certainly from my old school, and their eyes have opened when they come to London and see what property is. But the problem is it's a fairly intensive job trying to do that communication role, and the careers offices of schools generally do medicine, accountancy and solicitors. Those are the three things people seem to talk about more than real estate.
Yeah, it's really difficult to describe what a chartered surveyor does easily.
Yeah, and then you left Grosvenor. What year was that then?
That's a good question, actually, Guy. Such a long time. So I did 24 years at Grosvenor. I know, I didn't get my watch for the 25th year. In hindsight, it was a brilliant career, but I probably stayed too long.
Yeah.
And since I left Grosvenor, I've sort of moved about a bit because I've realised, you know, I need to do as much as I possibly can in my career before I can hang up my boots, really. So I did 5 years at Capco after Grosvenor. And I effectively, when I look at my career, I went from a private landlord, private company, to a publicly quoted FTSE 250, and then at Value Retail, a bit of a hybrid. So I've sort of done all three, really. And, you know, there are some benefits and some cons of each of those. But I think with Capco, it was really interesting going to a publicly quoted company because everyone knows what's going on. And the biggest challenge was the fact that the analysts would analyse every deal we did almost before they were completed. And you were very much in the public eye. And it was all about delivering short-term results. And Capco, Covent Garden, was all about driving the ERV. And wherever we got close to our ERV target, the CEO would increase it. But actually, I got into Covent Garden at a brilliant time. Capco had bought it 2 years earlier. They had a small team. There's only 16 of us when I joined.
Wow.
And it wasn't at that stage of interest to London institutions or really other landowners. It was seen as a tourist trap and not particularly attractive. And our raison d'etre was really to bring the Londoners back to Covent Garden and also to drive the retail to be much more aspirational / luxury. And effectively for 2 years, we bought anything we could buy around the market building. The market building Capco owned and quite a bit of the adjoining streets, but not enough to have critical mass. So I think in 2 years, we spent about 200 million on buying property, most of which was off market. And then what we would do, and most of it was not at prime yields, because at that stage, it really wasn't that attractive.
Okay.
And what we would then do was buy in the occupational tenant and relet, usually at least 30% more rent than the tenant that was in there, because we were able to bring exciting new brands to Covent Garden. We also spend a lot of money and a lot of time in placemaking, improving the public realm, like closing King Street to traffic, and really upping the ante from a marketing PR perspective.
And that was the big change. I think people saw, probably people enjoyed but didn't really notice the change in retail lineup or the F&B lineup as well, but people saw the placemaking that you did around there.
Yeah, exactly. And I think because we were able to build awareness through digital and through sort of our marketing and events activities, it started to come to Londoners' awareness that it wasn't before. But I think for me, the real change or the real shift was when we improved the food and beverage. I think we sort of focused hard on the retail, but actually when we bought Balthazar in, and when we did all the really cool small restaurants like Frenchie in Henrietta Street, it suddenly became a really cool place to eat, sort of aligned with Soho. And so the traffic became less tourists just there to have a gawp and a look around, and more people wanting to go there to experience really good food, but in an outdoor environment.
And when you chose to leave there, was it because the job was done, the placemaking, you know, you'd completed that, or was there another reason? Because it almost felt that you went in, you made the change, and then you left, and it was quite awesome, that journey. But was the job done, did you feel, when you left?
I think the easy bit was done. It got harder and harder as we bought a hell of a lot, probably bought as much as we possibly could. The yields are coming quite dramatically. We pushed the rents on James Street to £2,000 a foot. When I started there, they were under 1,000. There was still a lot to do in the peripheral streets. I'd been there 5 years. I was conscious of my age, and I was approached by Scott Malkin at Value Retail. So having been sort of happy and could have just carried on, this was an extra challenge. I'd always been intrigued by Bicester Village. I didn't set out to leave. It took me 6 months to make my mind up. Because I think I was very comfortable having worked in London for 30 years. I knew Westminster City Council, the councillors, the way it all worked. All my contact base were London. So for me, it was a bit of a risk moving out of the London arena, particularly if it didn't work. How would I get back in? But Scott Malkin persuaded me I should be doing it. So I then moved to Bicester Village as joint business director, I should say.
So Scott is a pretty awesome individual, I understand, because I did my university project on Bicester Village, and Value Retail were really helpful. But Scott was at the helm. It was Scott's baby from the very start, wasn't it?
And still is, yeah. Mm. He's an absolute visionary. He believes in disruption, and disruption adds value. And therefore, you never stood still. There were new initiatives happening all the time. It was an incredibly different business model to anything I'd ever seen. And in the 3 years I was there, I learned more about retail than I probably have in the previous 25 years. And that was retail as a retailer. There were 30 of us by the time I left Covent Garden. Wow. Running a Covent Garden asset that is probably worth similar to Value Retail, to Bicester Village. Bicester Village, there was 150 running the same size asset. And of that 150, there were 3 chartered surveyors.
Really?
So it, and 90% of the people, 95% of the people who worked on Bicester Village asset would not know what the rental income was. The business model was all about driving sales, and we had a sales target for the year. And it was all about working in partnership with the retailers to help them deliver their sales target. And the total sales target for Bicester Village was built up on the individual brand sales targets. Everything's on a turnover rent basis. So it was very much, they did well, we did well. And so much so that we had a retail team at Bicester Village that were in contact daily with both the brand at the store level, but also the brand at head office level, talking about what product's coming in, where are you placing it, how much product have you got, what's your pricing point. So really that minute, how are you going to show it in the shop? How are you going to work with us on our marketing activities? So it was very, very much like running a retail business rather than running a property asset.
The one thing I'm always amazed at when I stay in a hotel in London is you'll come out in the morning and there'll be a coach outside taking coach loads of people from the hotel up to Bicester Village. And it never ceases to amaze me how, you know, integrated the model does seem to be between the retail, the customer and the real estate.
You're absolutely right. They got in incredibly early with the Chinese. As Chinese tourism was taking off, it was all through the government that the Chinese could get out of China. And it was all on government tours. So in one fell swoop, you could, by working with the government, bring thousands of Chinese to the UK rather than individual travellers, which countries like India do. So we were able to work with the Chinese tourism authorities 15 years ago. And it's become, you know, it's as well known as London, effectively. It was the second, it was number 2 on the tourism destination for Chinese visiting Britain after Buckingham Palace.
Were you able to bring your expertise from Covent Garden and what you'd done there with brands to Bicester, or were they ahead of the game almost in terms of Covent Garden?
I think the brand relationship is quite different at Value Retail than it is with property companies. It's much less a landlord-tenant relationship. Yeah. And in many ways, I mean, Capco was halfway there, but it's a very difficult, it's a very different model. It's a very cost-intensive model, having so many people there. But because the sales are so strong at Bicester Village, it works. And I had a lot of visits from a lot of the, put it this way, the London property companies with retail portfolios and shopping centre owners, really trying to get under the skin as to what they do. And they sort of say to me, you know, you've come from where we are, can we do the same? And my view is there are certain things that definitely can be done. And the approach to marketing, particularly digital, is one area. But really, unless you change your model and effectively get rid of all your surveyors and bring in retailers, it's a really difficult model to replicate. Oh, and change the way you charge your tenants and take the risk and go full turnover, then it is quite a difficult model to replicate.
How did you end up? So you're in absolutely probably the best retail address, Bicester Village, I would say, in the country, you know, debatably after Bond Street, maybe. You've gone from there to an incredible comprehensive project with Bicester Motion. How did you move, before we talk about Bicester Motion in detail, how did that happen?
Again, a bit by coincidence, to be honest, Guy. When I moved to Bicester Village, I didn't want to drive an hour and a half each way from London. So I found a couple of Airbnbs. And the second one I found was on this thing called Bicester Heritage, which was the old RAF Bicester site, which was dated from 1926. It's the best preserved RAF station. It had been left by the MOD for 30 years, effectively, and then bought by a group of individuals 8 years ago. And they had refurbished and redeveloped all the original buildings. And one of the 40 buildings, they had converted into four Airbnb rooms that they call crew rooms. And I stayed there and I loved it so much. I ended up staying there 3-4 nights a week. My own little sort of room with kitchenette. I almost left my stuff there. And the guy who was the CEO, Dan Gayagan, the lady who organised the crew room, said, you really should meet Dan. And you, of course, said, I went to school with him and put us in touch. Next thing I know, I'm meeting him for breakfast in their office that was literally the next door building to the Airbnb. He talked me through his vision and master plan, and I just thought, bloody hell, that is amazing. And we just sort of kept talking, really. And then he would say to me, at some stage, I'm going to have to get someone in sort of to lead the property side of it. Do you know anyone? And we kept talking. And then about this time last year, I decided, I mean, Valuator was great fun, but it is really, really full on. Yeah. You know, you can get phone calls at 11 o'clock at night, 5 o'clock in the morning. I was working 7 days a week. I'd always hankered after doing my own thing. So I decided that I would set up my own consultancy, and then went back, and Dan and I had talked, you know, constantly. And we sort of just came to an arrangement that I would start with them in the new year as their property director on a 4-day-a-week basis. So that gave me the confidence to hand in my notice and to set up my consultancy company, which I did as of January. Having said that, Scott thought it was slightly illogical that I was thinking of leaving. And we had some amazing discussions over the last 6 months of my full-time time there. And as a result, I stayed on and I do 1 day a week for Value Retail. And that is really concentrating on the synergies between Bicester Motion and Value Retail and how we can leverage them for the benefit of both parties.
Oh, wow.
So at the minute, as of January, I'm doing that. But clearly Value Retail, they were closed for 3 months. So effectively I have not done anything with them for 3 months other than just monitor what's going on between the two businesses. I also took on a non-exec in January, and I also help out Howard de Walden as a strategic advisor for them on their retail portfolio.
Okay.
So I've sort of got back to more than a full-time job, but loving it.
That's fantastic. And back to Bicester Motion. What are your jobs effectively to do? Because the ambition is huge. So perhaps you can talk a bit about the ambition and you know, where you fit into that in terms of delivery.
Yes, of course. So The first phase, which is effectively the refurbishment of the existing RAF base building. So there's 450 acres. There is an airfield with land around it, but only 5% of the land is the sort of what I would call the RAF base itself, the buildings. All of those, or the majority of those buildings, have now been refurbished and have become the hub of the classic car industry. So when Dan and there were 21 investors invested in the project, buying the airfield and then investing in the refurbishment of these buildings. They all had one thing in common. They all absolutely loved classic cars, or petrol heads, as I sort of call them. And the way they described to me is, it's not a cottage industry. It's a £1 billion industry, but it's very disparate. So you will get a guy who refurbishes, for example, classic Porsches, who works out of some farm buildings in Wales. You should identify with that guy. And that's what they all do. So what Dan and colleagues have done is brought a number of those industries together under different roofs, but one umbrella roof. And he's basically curated a tenant mix, or a brand mix, a mix of the best specialists in all different areas. And they work together, and the synergies between them is absolutely phenomenal. So, for example, we have a guy who, as his hobby, started doing up 1920s to 1930s Bentleys. Mm-hmm. And now it's become his business, and he's got a building which has got five of them. They're probably worth at least £1 million each. Wow. And he does them up for clients. He's got one client who races them and then hands them back to him to basically rebuild for the next season. We've got guys who trade in 1920s, 1930s cars, or there's a guy who trades in Porsches. Guys who look after classic oils. We've got the guy who builds and restores vintage radiators. He's one of two in the country. One of two guys who look after magnetos. These are things I'd never heard of before in January. As you can imagine, for me, a car is four wheels, and I look very much at the colour of the car and has it got front heated seats, basically. That's where I was before I joined Vista Heritage. And it's just fascinating how these businesses work together and how their businesses have proved dramatically all being in one amazing environment. And it is an amazing environment. It's very calm. It's beautifully laid out, as they were laid out by Trenchard, I think, was the mastermind about it. And there is a hub. One of the guys who has... called Auto Wax Works, who basically puts films on cars to protect them. He's got a little cappuccino bar next door, which has become the hub. We've got our own brewery. Again, another petrol head who races classic cars, set up a brewery called the Wrigley Monkey. And he was the one who's probably done the best during lockdown, because he offered free delivery in the Bicester area. Now he can't bottle it fast enough. Wow. And as a result of the demand, we've built another 9 units, raising slightly bigger units, so between 4,000 and 10,000 square feet. They're contemporary, but they're built in the classic style, so they're brick and clad. And we are letting those at £15 a foot, whereas most sort of warehouses in that area are going for £6. And again, we're trying to take the classic industry into the future. So we have got two people coming to us who are building electric supercars, either designers or actually building them. We've got a company called Hero, who basically organise all the classic car rallies around the country. You can do Peking to Paris, apparently.
I'm a customer. I did the Land's End to John O'Groats rally with them year before last.
Ah, right. So you know them. So you can actually... Yep. You can race your own car through it, or you can, even if you don't want that, you can rent one of their cars for the weekend. And I think you can probably rent a navigator or even a driver if you want to do it.
You're learning all the things here, Sarah Jane.
Hmm?
You're learning all the terms here.
Well, I'm not. So I'm learning by default, but I am finding, having worked in retail for so long, this is just such a different way of, it's sort of retail, but in a different way.
If you compare it to retail, that's what I love about the model, which retail never do, is that it's vertically integrated, in that I think Motorsport UK are coming onto site reasonably soon. And then you've got everything all the way down through the restorers and the effectively the manufacturers and the product makers through to the new social media. So you've got Mr. JWW as
he was there yesterday in his McLaren.
And so you've got Road Rat, which is the magazine. Absolutely.
So Road Rat, for me, is the monocle of the car industry.
Yep.
And these guys have been working from a mezzanine of someone's barn with a tin roof. So they're, you know, they say their laptops sort of crash in the summer. So they took the old parachute store. They actually moved in last week. They moved in. What I love about it, everyone brings their dog with them. So they moved in, the three guys from Road Rat plus Mary the Labrador, last Friday. Mr. JWW is fitting out his bunker, will have its own turntable. And he is, for me, I said, how the hell do I describe him? They said he's effectively this generation, really, isn't he? He's for the millennials. He's just fascinating. So he drives all of these high performance cars. We have a track, so he basically drives them on our track. And then his Instagram followers are absolutely, absolutely massive. So we are getting effectively free PR by the fact that he's there, and also with the Road Rat coming to join us. And we have, it is absolutely huge, but that is only 5% of the site. So the next thing is we're building the events business, and the scrambles that we do 4 times a year or did started off being 600 people, and the one we had in January was 8,500 people. And effectively, it is open to anyone to bring their car, to bring their modern classic or classic car. And you can have a top of the range Aston Martin sitting next to an Escort Mexico, and it's full of people who love cars. And our specialists, or our tenants, but I love the word specialist, they open their doors and they're there and they talk about what they do. So it's a very lovely way of integrating people's passion in a fabulous environment. And that business, we've got a hangar as well, which we rent out. So we get a lot of photo shoots. And so we're building the events business, but that literally is only 5% of the site. So we have planning consent for a 340-room hotel, and we're just reviewing the viability of that, just testing the number of rooms. It's also going to be a conference centre, but that will be, in many ways, the hub for the rest of, or the catalyst for change for the rest of the master plan. We will put a planning application in for what we call an experience quarter, which is effectively a brand centre with four-wheel drive, various tracks. But the focus isn't on driving as fast as you can around the tracks, but it's on all different types of mobility, from electric scooters, you name it, drones, bikes. What we want to do is to become known for all different types of mobility, all different types of wheels, and also to be not just for the petrol head, but really a family place. We bought an 85-acre ex-quarry, and the idea is to convert that into a reserve so that there is a public area where people can come and bring their dogs, bring their bikes, there'll be nature trails, there are three lakes, so there'll be paddleboarding and everything like that. And then we're talking to a company that runs reserves in Africa to have effectively an African reserve without the animals around the second lake, but very much open to nature. Hopefully have a survival academy with that. And then around the third lake, we're looking at putting some second homes, some private homes around that. So that's another project. And the final project is what we're calling the innovation quarter, which effectively is looking at the future of the automotive, the aviation sector. So really trying to find those businesses that are all about the future, particularly the businesses who want to use the track But also are very happy that the public can engage with them, so that, you know, you can try out the newest in electric technology, for example, going forward. You can try that out either via our brand centre or by going to see them in the innovation quarter. So what started at the past is very much looking towards the future.
It's incredibly ambitious.
I've known about that for so long, haven't I? Sorry.
Well, I love the fact you know what an escort Mexico is, Sarah Jane, because when we worked together, I don't think you even knew what an escort was.
There is a story behind that. When I first went out with my boyfriend that's now my husband, he had one of those, and I thought it was the most hideous thing and refused to go in it and effectively forced him to sell it for, I think, an Astra. And they're now worth about, what, 40, 50 grand?
Yeah,
sort of eat my words, Guy, effectively.
So with all of this, has your taste in cars changed, or are you still a BMW X5 driver?
No, I'm not a BMW X5 driver anymore. Has my taste in car drive? I hanker after a 1970s Porsche because my grandfather had a 1973 911 E bright green, Guy. If I could find it and it was still around, I'd love to be able to buy it. I don't think I ever will be someone who collects cars, classic cars. But I do find them fascinating, and I'd love to drive a few of them. I think I'd be absolutely appalling at driving them, but I'd love to have a go, basically.
It's just an incredible journey, Sarah Jane, you've been on, because you certainly did the gilt edge thing for 24 years at Grosvenor, and then the high-end retail at both ends of the scale, and now what a fantastic opportunity Bicester is. But I think your problem is going to be deciding, it's a job for life, Bicester, in the sense of it's never ending, isn't it? There is no end in sight, because the project will never be completed, for the sound of things.
There's always the current master plan is probably 5-7 years, but there will be always things to do. I mean, in the existing part, there are still buildings that are untouched. There are four hangars there. And there's a lot of work that could be done. One could be an absolutely amazing exhibition expo centre, for example. So yes, there's loads and loads of potential. At the minute, we're a team of 12 people.
And are the Airbnb apartments still available?
Oh, they are. Go on the website and look at Bicester Heritage Crew Rooms. Worth it. The style is very RAF sort of 1930s, 1940s, they're lovely. And what you get is you get a fabulous environment with 24-hour security that you can wander around at night.
Well, that's what I might have to come down and see you. So, thank you very much for all of that. That's just amazing. And I've been meaning to do this for a long time. I'm really glad we have done it, because it's an amazing journey. And well, we hope to have an update at some point, maybe have a tour around and have a look and see how it's going.
Guy, thank you for the introduction of Dan. It's probably your fault, really.
Well, he's an awesome guy. Dan, out of interest, is the guy who runs Bicester Motion and owns it effectively. But Dan was at school with me and used to drive in a 1920s or 30s car with the hood down, which is about the only person in the whole of the UK who probably was going to school driving himself in an
Alvis, probably.
Vintage car. So, well, thank you, Sarah Jane. I really appreciate your time, and we'll follow up at some point in the future. But thank you so much for your time.
No problem. Thank you.
Great. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.